He was teaching us how he wanted New Vrindavan to be established. West Virginia, New Vrindavan. So in other words, Srila Prabhupada wanted this community to expand beyond the 120 acres on the mountain. I believe the next place that was procured was this farm, which was named Bahulabhan. The old farmhouse that many of us entered into to get into this temple, that was all that was here at that time. This temple that we're sitting in is considered by the old-time Vrijavasis of New Vrindavan to be a very new, modern addition. That little hall that we walked through was the temple of Sri Sri Radha Vrindavan Chandra. One third of it was the altar, and the other two thirds of that small room was the temple room. That was the main temple for the whole New Vrindavan community. Sri Sri Radha Vrindavan Chandra were worshipped with great, great devotion. In those days, New Vrindavan was so poor. The devotees were way below the poverty level as far as their standard of living. But still the deities were worshipped with much opulence. Because there was the belief that if you water the root of the tree, the whole tree will flourish. Sri Sri Radha Vrindavan Chandra are the root of this community. And by following Srila Prabhupada's teachings, we could actually water that root. So the devotees, although they lived so very, very simple, they were ecstatic to see the opulence, the beauty, and the wonderful services offered to the deities. Actually, in 1972, Srila Prabhupada told the devotees all over the world that he would be coming to New Vrindavan for his Vyas Puja and for Lord Sri Krishna's Janmashtami. And during that time, he would give a series of lectures which he entitled the Bhagavad Dharma Discourses. In doing so, he was really establishing New Vrindavan as a place of pilgrimage for the whole of North America. So it is a fact, devotees from all over the country came here to New Vrindavan. And they came here some days before Srila Prabhupada. It was really amazing. In this small room outside, everyone please look at it, there were the entire community, plus temple presidents and leaders from most of the centers in all of America, crowded in that room for Mangalarti, for Srimad Bhagavatam class, and for the entire morning and evening programs. So thinking that this is supposed to be a national pilgrimage and so many devotees are coming, the idea came to build an addition to the house. At that time, the addition only went to where that gate was. This was the wall. I remember when I first came, I was seeing Bhagwarananda Prabhu laying the marble on the floor, and Shamakul Prabhu and others building the walls and the roof. And it was a very, very intense spirit of enthusiasm that we wanted to move the deities in here on the day of Janmashtami. And Srila Prabhupada would come here and bless the occasion. So it was frantic. It was frantic because there was probably a year's worth of work to be done in a couple of weeks. Devotees were working 24 hours. And Janmashtami day, the walls still had not been painted. There was still carpentry to be done. So devotees were literally working frantically. I remember this was a marble altar, and the deities were brought in, and Prabhupada was to be coming, and there was about 30 or 40 devotees just working like mad under Kulaji Prabhu's direction. Kirtanananda Swami was very strong that we have to finish everything before Prabhupada walks through the door. There was paint on the floor, paint on the walls, and we were praying that when Prabhupada came in, he wouldn't touch the walls. Because literally, they were painted minutes before. And I remember I was standing right, sitting, I was with a razor blade, trying to remove paint spots from this marble right here. And Prabhupada came through this door. And as he was coming through this door, all these ladders and buckets and other devotees were going out of that way. Somehow, that when he walked in, everything was complete. There was nobody cleaning anything. Just running. Prabhupada's coming. When his car pulled up, they said, Prabhupada's coming. Everyone started running because there was no back door. There was a side door. And it just came out as he came in. And he saw the deities on the altar, Sri Srirata and Ravan Chandra. How very, very pleased he was. It was the inauguration of the new temple of Vrindavan on Janmashtami of 1972. Prabhupada's Vyasa sign is just about where it is right now today, except a little forward. And he wanted to have, after the worship of the deities, he wanted to have it was after the arti, the midnight arti, he wanted to have Krishna book reading. And to tell this story, I'm going to request Kulaji Prabhu. And also request him to coordinate the further discussion for our pilgrimage to Bahubali. Kulaji Prabhu, please. When all this was built, Kulaji Prabhu was the president. He has incredible realizations and sublime memories. Not only does he know what was done, but he knows the esoteric inside stories.
Well, we hope we can give everyone a little insight into the transcendental lila of their lordships Radha Vrindavan Chandra. As Maharaj explained, we had very little, next to nothing, but everything. We had the cows and we had the deities. And everything that we had would go into the worship of the deities and the protection of the cows. There was nothing else at New Vrindavan for us to do. Our daily sadhana, the opulent worship of Radha Vrindavan Chandra, the cooking for the deities, and the protection of the cows. In those days, our sadhana, we would rise between 2, 2.15, two, of course, Maharaj, you were up all night. Right? That's another topic, right there. Be in the temple at 2.30, chant our japa before Mangalarti, we would have Mangalarti. Then we would have Bhagavatam class, Tulsi Pooj, Bhagavatam class. I think breakfast was at 6.30. And then we'd be out by 7 o'clock in the fields or whatever service. There were just not many people at that time. Not many devotees. In the beginning, we didn't have the oat water for breakfast. That came after a few years of experiencing cow's milk and oatmeal together, and everyone
had mucus and coughs, and later on we developed the oat water, famous oat water. The reason I bring that up is because Pradhamadhamma Chandra's prasadam was extraordinary. Everywhere we would, when we'd meet with Srila Prabhupada, we would bring him prasadam from Radhavadam Chandra. We would, for Mangalarti, I think we had 15 different types of milk sweets for the deities every day. Then we had the breakfast offering, which was 12 preparations, Malpuras, Parada, Halwa, more milk sweets. Then Rajbhog offering every day for the deities, 64 items. Then there was the famous 4 o'clock offering, which was the cheesecake, the fried curd, more milk sweets, cookies. The 4 o'clock offering was exciting because, well, first of all, because we were almost starving. And during the construction, Kirtananda would often, we would distribute the 4 o'clock offering for those devotees that had had an exceptionally hard day working hard or got some, achieved some goal in construction or were bringing in the hay. So they would distribute in the middle of the afternoon, sometimes the late afternoon, the 4 o'clock offering. Then later on when we had Jagannath, that's what we're talking about. Please, nobody let Tapa Punch leave in the back. So, then when the Big Lord Jagannath, I don't know if I'm talking about Old Vrindavan, Maharaj explained that Big Lord Jagannath came from the trees from Old Vrindavan. Big Lord Jagannath at the temple was carved from a tree that had come from the along the road on the way to Vrindavan. Narayan had carved him. That was one of my first services, was to paint Big Lord Jagannath. And then when they went to Madhavan at one point, Mother Ladini used to make a similar 4 o'clock offering, but her famous preparation were this cinnamon bun. For the construction crews on the palace at 4 o'clock, she would just make these huge cinnamon buns, and the brahmacharis, primarily the work crew at the palace, they used to get the cinnamon buns from Lord Jagannath and the fried curd. Then in the 6 o'clock offering, we used to have savories, sabjis, I would say about another dozen preparations. Then there was the milk sweets that were put on the altar all night for the deities. Did I miss one? There was an 8 o'clock. It was after the 6 o'clock, there was an 8 o'clock offering. And then after that, some sweets were given to the deities for overnight. And because the devotees were eating, we were eating in the mood of giving everything to Krishna, all the money that went into the bhoga was for the Mahaprasad primarily. Then secondarily we would have simple grains. At times we didn't even have chapatis. It took too many people to roll the chapatis, so we would just have simple rice or dal, or sometimes upma made from cow corn, ground up, not even the proper, depending what we could afford. But all that, for the bhoga, all that went into the Mahaprasada. And that analogy Maharaj was using by watering the root, then the prasadam would come back to the devotees for morning prasadam. We would store the Mahaprasadam all day long from the offerings. You'll see in there, there's a closet. Well, we used to have a small cabinet in the prasad room. But sometimes the devotees would become so mad after the prasad room that at night when everyone was asleep,
Well, when the door was ripped off the prasadam cabinet, then we had to put it in the closet. And there was one time when they would pull the doors to reach their fingers up in to try and grab anything. You could see scrape marks in the subway. So then the temple commander would put little tacks along the edge. So they could reach up there. Because the devotees were so mad for the Mahaprasadam that they tried, everyone was very protective of the Mahaprasadam. So then in the next morning when we were taking prasadam or chanting japa, some devotees, you would see the scratches on the back of their hand. So the devotees, we wonderful opulent prasadam, Sri Sri Radhavindavan Chandra. Then we would have our breakfast, oat water and rice, and then we would get a nice plate of Mahaprasadam. And the devotees were very satisfied. Prasadam was so wonderful. And the same with the deities, the outfits. We were basically living in jeans and sweat clothes. I think we had polyester dhotis, and I didn't even think we had cotton dhotis, because in New York when we would go, I would go with Kirtana Swami, and then I would go myself, spending thousands of dollars. We'd go to the fanciest places in New York, buying silk, imported silk, imported lace, jewel, not, of course, not real jewels, but the expensive cut glass, and the spending thousands of dollars on the deity's outfit. Each outfit was thousands of dollars, and then there was one devotee who lived here for years, Ishani, and we would buy all of these medals and jewels so that he could, she would just make crowns, hand make all the crowns for the deities. And every piece of silk was hand embroidered or inlaid with jewels by the devotees. So that again, the devotees were dressed so simple, living so simple, and the deities were, you know, their outfits were worth thousands and thousands of dollars. And that was our mood, to try and serve the deities, Sri Sri Radhavindavan Chandra. And the devotees, every morning, the greeting of the deities would be such an anxious moment. Remember, we would have incense burning, and then when the curtains would open and the incense would separate, and there would be the deities. And every morning was, because they were the center of the community. Again, nothing, no TV, no newspapers for years, for the first, from 70 to early 80s. We were so separate from the outside. All we had were the deities and the cows. There was a time, I remember, when we were, Prabhupada talked about Sri Sri Radhavindavan Chandra, and he said they look like the young boys and girls from our movement. Young American boys and girls. And of course he said they were the most beautiful deities. Of course he's glorified deities everywhere, but we remember that quote. The most beautiful. Go ahead, Marsh.
Let me catch up. If you say it's okay, we'll hand it back.
Would you like to know how we would take our bath? This was famous throughout ISKCON. Or should I say infamous? The bathing facilities was about a 6-7 minute walk from here through thick mud. We'd have to climb down a small hill, which was the cow pasture. And there was a hole in the ground where the cows would drink water. That is where the devotees would take their bath. It was called the bathing ghat. Some devotees just made a... At the beginning, we would just stand in the mud. But we realized we were dirtier than when we started. So there was just an old piece of wood that was put there that we could step on. And we would have these cut open 1 gallon milk cartons, and we would take that and dip it in and then pour it on us. Which sounds nice, but in the summer especially, all the water was coming from the mountains. So it was thick mud. It was literally thick brown mud. And when you pour it over yourself, you would just see just mud going over your whole body. But we considered we were being purified by the waters from New Vrindavan. But when other devotees would come from other centers to take their bath, they would see us pouring mud all over our body. And in those days, there were no such thing as towels or gumshoes. We would just, with our hand, we would just slap as much of it off as we can and then get dressed.
Drip dry.
It was drip dry.
And in the winter?
In 1972, when all these devotees from all over the movement were coming, everyone had to take their bath there. And they were shocked. There were just crowds of people on this little piece of wood just pouring mud over their bodies. In their kopis, which we call Brahmin underwear. And the problem was, it wasn't far from the road. And when neighbors would drive by, they would see these people with loincloths, which is completely unheard of in America, loincloths. They would see all these men with shaved heads with loincloths pouring mud all over them. So naturally they thought we were some sort of a strange cult. We were sued for it, was brought to court for indecent exposure or something.
The defense brought up that they're bathing naked. Of course, they saw in saffron, sometimes you can't tell, and it looks like skin, so they thought we were completely naked. So the prosecutor said, they're bathing naked. And the judge said, well, I bathe naked.
Prabhu knows the esoteric aspect. That was the summer bathing. Winter bathing is we go down this sloshy, muddy little hill to get to the bathing ghat. And there would be about a 1-inch thick sheet of ice covering the whole thing. There was a special rock that was kept there. It was called the ice-breaking rock. We break the rock, and then we dip it in, and the water would be as cold as ice. Literally, ice cold. And still muddy. And we would go down there at 2 o'clock in the morning, everybody, because we all woke up by 2 o'clock, and we would try to be in the temple by 2:30, because we had to finish all our round by about 4 or 4:30.
No lights anywhere.
There was no lights in the temple. No lights. So we go in the when there was no moon, it was pitch dark. We have to go through the barn, then. Sometimes it was so slippery to get to the ghat that we'd have to crawl down there through the mud. Break the ice, freezing cold. And I remember when you pour the water over your whole body would just steam. You couldn't even see people. There would be so much smoke coming off their body because the body's warm and the water's cold. Their whole body would just be steaming. And then they'd drip dry, trying to scrape as much water off. And then we come to the temple.
You have to run back.
Run.
Ice water on it.
Yes, running.
Unless your boot got stuck in the mud. Well, we used to wear those sandals, but they weren't really sandals, they were called flip-flops. These thin little rubber, you know, and there's the one between the first toe. So when you'd run over, inevitably, someone would lose at least one of their sandals, running back, because they were wet. So you're always, but you had to wait for the sun to come up later to go find your sandal, because you couldn't find it in the bush. Because you had to, as he said, you had to run 5 or 10 minutes over at the freezing cold. And then there were always the shoe thieves. That, because the devotees were so indigent, there were limited amounts of shoes. There was always, well, there was one person who had a great reputation for borrowing other people's shoes. That was Garga Rishi Prabhu. Anytime someone was missing shoes, just like yesterday at the temple, my shoes, I had stopped at one door, but my shoes weren't there. Someone had worn them around to another door. This was a common practice at Vrindavan. And anytime anyone was missing shoes, not even shoes, just dhoti, anything, we would always ask, where's Garga Rishi?
He never said he took it, but he always...
He would never say he took the shoes, but he somehow always knew where they were.
On one occasion, I had received my first, as Claudry said, no, I don't need that.
I'm from Brooklyn, I don't really need this.
On, Claudry had mentioned that our dhotis were polyester, which meant, and all our cooking was on uncontrollable wood stoves, and in the temple were the wood burners, and wearing the polyester dhotis meant that if you got too close, your dhoti would melt. Even from a foot away, you'd feel your dhoti start to crinkle. You'd look down and see your dhoti melting. But I received my first cotton dhoti, and in those days, we had numbers on all of our clothes, and as my name started with A, I was number one. And everything you had, your bowl, your plate, your laundry bag, all had your number on it, so you could find it. And so I got my first dhoti, cotton dhoti, and had my number one in the corner. And when is Garga Rishi here, by the way? Oh, okay. Is Mudakar? So I went into the bathhouse with my new cotton dhoti, and I put it on the shelf, and went behind the wall to bathe. And when I came out, my dhoti was missing. My brand new from India cotton dhoti, which was a very special occurrence when you were wearing polyester. And so the next day I come in the bathhouse and I'm bathing, again in a polyester dhoti, and I see a beautiful white cotton dhoti on the shelf. So I pick up the cotton dhoti and I turn to the corner where my number would be, and the corner is ripped off. So I look behind the wall and here's Garga Rishi. And I say, Rish! I go, Rish, this is my dhoti! And he goes, that damn Mudakari. For you who don't know, Mudakari was Garga Rishi's wife. But she was not in the bathhouse the day before.
Kalaji Prabhu was talking about shoes. I came to India and I had these little rubber chappals. On the first day, it got stuck so deep in the mud that I couldn't find it. So I had nothing. So I was barefoot. And Vrindavan was really rough terrain in those days. So when you wanted anything, you would requisition, because no one was allowed to leave the community and there was no way to go to town. So I asked if I could get a pair of boots. Devotees used to wear the cheapest possible rubber boots. So I requisitioned it, and they never came. So I was walking barefoot around the community for 1 month. And finally my feet were so torn apart. I had staph infection and really, really swollen. So Kirtan Ananda Swami saw it, and he said, "Why are you not taking care of your body?" And I said, "Well, I've been requisitioning boots for a month now." So about a week later, he said, "I have boots for you." And Adipati's wife, Prachi Devi's mother, sent her some rain boots from very, very thin for covering for high heel shoes. Just a little rubber coating for high heel shoes.
High heel shoes.
So he goes, "Who knows?" And in one day they were torn to pieces. So then I was asking around, "How do you get boots?" And devotees told me the secret. You have to wait till someone bloops. When people leave New Vrindavan, they rarely take their boots with them. So you have to just wait and watch. Just watch very carefully if somebody's having problems. If the boots, if it looks like they're going to leave, you identify which boots they have. And if you don't see it at Mangal Arati, before somebody else gets it, you go to the boot rack outside and put your number on it.
He's actually being kind. The fact of the matter is that Kirtananda Swami would even send someone after someone who was taking their boots to get them back while they were halfway up the road to bring the boots back. It's one of Sudanu's favorite stories.
The devotees were really ascetics. I mean, bathing, it's 0 degrees outside, breaking the ice, pouring, walking, you know, across about the length of a soccer field. I remember when we were living at what we then called the New Barn, and they were constructing the utility building. They had all the footer ditches built, and so many mothers would get lost. They'd be walking across, and they'd fall in one of the ditches. We were just so callous to our bodily needs at the time. And the devotees would develop these huge cracks on their feet because it was so cold, and there were, you know, we weren't socks, we were wearing sandals in and out, and no socks in the boots, because washing the clothes was the real challenge. At one time we were making our own soap, and I was making the soap. Of course, I wasn't very good. In the process of making soap, you have to use, all of our heat came from burning wood. So there was a formula in one of these natural books on how to make soap, where you take lye and you mix it with ashes. Yeah, but if you don't do it right, you burn your hands and your clothes get filthy with ashes. So some of the early batches of soap were like that. Kirtananda refused to buy soap, said we have to make our own, until it was burning holes in the dhotis and people were getting. So they had the crack, we would have cracks in our feet, cracks in our hands from the cold, and of course there was no running water, so we had to go to the well. And there was no running hot water, so any warm water you needed would have to have been heated up on some fire somewhere. So, quite often when we were milking the cows, there would be a parade of devotees to come, because when you're milking cows, they have this udder balm for keeping the cows tender for milking. But the devotees would have it put all over their feet and all over their hands to help kind of soften the skin from the cold and from the cold water. So, and of course, Gargarishi probably had the biggest cracks in his feet. I seem to remember that.
Gargarishi did have the biggest cracks in his feet.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time I saw Gargarishi, I was sitting in the prasadam room out here, and I'd been here for about 2 or 3 weeks, and he was living up on the Vrindavan farm. and the sink out here was not working. So they said they were going to send for the plumber. And so I was sitting in the prasadam room when the plumber arrived, and the plumber was Gargarishi. And I was sitting on the floor, sitting against the wall, and this devotee came walking, a brahmachari came walking across the room. And I looked at his feet, and the cracks on his feet were so horrendous. They were like an inch, gashing cracks going all the way around his feet. And another thing I'd just like to say about the soap, Kaladri again is being kind. When I came in 1973 and came in this building, there was a festival, and after the cooking, the devotees asked me to help wash the pots. So I went to the place near the well where the devotees were washing the pots. And what they had for you to wash the pots, and Kaladri was right, Kirtananda Maharaj would not buy any soap. And in the to wash the pots, there was one bucket of sand and one bucket of ashes. And then you took the ashes and sand and put it on the burnt part in the pot and scraped it with a rock. And that was my first experience of soap in Vrindavan. There was no lie in it. Dish soap, Vrindavan style.
Maybe we could talk about the buildings that were here before. There was the farmhouse. Then, very early on, they built the cabin for Kirtananda. There was what was called the corn crib. That may have been before. I don't know. Do you remember the corn crib? You used to live in the corn crib. No, that was true. There was one other person that had big cracks, by the way. Taru. Taru had very big cracks.
Devakinanda.
Yeah, he used to live. There was a corn crib, and then there was an old block building here, which later became the incense factory. We were trying to sell the incense as spiritual sky incense, one of the early businesses Prabhupada recommended. Then there was the block building down here in the front, which became the deity kitchen. And then to the side of the deity kitchen, we had what we called the pits. Pits were four big cut-off barrels that we used for cooking the devotee prasadam. You know, if you take a 55-gallon drum and you cut it in half, then you cut holes in the sides, and then you put a grill across it, that's how we cook the devotee prasadam. That's also how you develop cataracts in your eyes if the wooden smoke comes up day after day, month after month, year after year. So there was the farmhouse. There was the kitchen building, there was the incense warehouse, there was the corn crib, and then there was the original barn. Then there was, between them, there was that little building, which became the bathhouse.
And later on, the milk kitchen.
Then there was also the tool shed that was out in the back here, which later became the outhouse, well, in that area. And what else?
In regard to those buildings, I'll tell you a little story. When I first came here in 1973, I went and saw Kirtananda Maharaj and I made a donation of $1,000, which for me at the time was a lot of money. And then I asked Kirtananda Maharaj if I could come and live here. And he told me, yes, I could come and live. I could come and live here. And I asked, is there a place for me to live? And I was married at the time, and he said, yes, there's a place for you to live. So I went back to New York and got rid of all of my possessions, and then came back to New Vrindavan a couple of weeks later. And actually, when I left, I asked him, is there anything you need from New York? And he said, yeah, he made me a list. And that list cost me about $3,500. And I pulled up with a U-Haul, and Gopinath and the other devotees loaded it into the storage room. And then I went up to Kirtananda Maharaj, and I said, Maharaj, I'm here, you know, where should I live? And Kaladri wasn't here at the time, he was in India, so there was a devotee named Radhakanta who was kind of taking over for Kaladri while he was gone. So
Kirtananda Swami from his cabin up there told me to come down into the prasada room here where I'd find Radhakanta, and Radhakanta could tell me where we would live. So I went to Radhakanta and I said, Harbal Prabhu, he was sitting in this room out here playing harmonium with Devakinanda chanting. So I sat and waited for them to finish. And then I walked over and I said, Harbal Prabhu, Kirtananda Swami told me to come down here and see you about finding a place to live. And he looked up at me and he said, he told you to come and see me? He had a really big southern drawl. And I said, yeah, he told me to come and see you, and I'll have to ask Radhavrindava Chandra's forgiveness, but this is what he said. He said, son of a... he knows there's no place for you to live. What did he tell you to come see me for? So then I went back up to Kirtananda Maharaj's cabin, and I said, Maharaja, Radhakanta says there is no place for me to live. He said, oh, well, hold on a minute. So then he went and got some other devotees, and they talked, and he came back, and he said, there was another building, but it's no longer here. And this is the building he told me to live in. He said, well, down in the parking lot below the temple, there's an old ice cream truck that was donated. It's a square, just a little square ice cream truck. He said, you can stay in there for a few days until we can get you an apartment. So I said, well, okay. You know, so we went down there, and my wife and I loaded all of our belongings into the ice cream truck. And the first night, we slept with every article of clothing that we had. It was January 17th, by the way. And we slept with every article of clothing that we owned on us, and every blanket, and cuddled very closely. And still, we were froze all night long. We couldn't sleep. We were that cold. So the next day, I went to Kirtananda Maharaj, and I said, Maharaj, you know, not for nothing, but we're freezing to death. You know, and he said, well, hold on, we'll get you a little heater. So he said, there'll be an apartment any time now. So he got us in a heater, and we put that heater on. He was right. The next day, it was actually that night we were warm. But when I went up to bathe, and if you get a chance, you can look right into where I'm sitting here, is the boiler room. At that time, that was the men's bathhouse as well. If you look in there, you'll understand a little something about New Vrindavan. And I went in there to bathe. I was late for Mangalarti, and there was only one other devotee in there bathing, and he looked at me kind of strange, and I didn't think anything of it. You know, and I finished bathing, and I came running up to try and get in for Mangalarti and stopped at the mirror to put on my tilak. And when I looked into the mirror, I saw that my entire face was black. Except I kind of looked a little like Al Jolson.
That man!
You know, little white lines where my eyes... So I look in that mirror and I'm like, oh my God! And, you know, so I put my chad over my head, running here from Mangalarti. After Mangalarti, I run out, and then I go back to Kirtananda Maharaj later that day. And I said, Maharaj, we were warmer. Thank you. But I think if we spend another night there, we may die from the fumes. So he said, okay, here's what you can do. If you can leave all of your belongings in the truck, but at night, you can sleep in the incense warehouse. The incense warehouse was a very small block building, smaller than this kitchen building, the old one outside, smaller than that. And the walls were lined with shelves, and there was just a walkway down the middle. And so at night, we would just sleep in the walkway, bring our clothes up from the truck, bathe, and then roll out a sleeping bag and sleep in the walkway. I might add, on the bulletin board on that wall in the warehouse, there was only one article, and it was the first night I ever came to New Vrindavan, I actually spent in that incense warehouse with my wife. And the one article on that bulletin board said, was a newspaper article saying how a few months before the devotees had been shot by bikers who visited the temple. So my wife and I are here on our first night, we're reading this article.
bikers shoot Hare Krishnas. And so, there was one other article. It wasn't an article. There was a bulletin board on the temple in here. The next morning, my wife and I came to the temple for kirtan, and afterward we went outside and I was reading the article on that bulletin board. It wasn't a newspaper article. It was written by the devotees. But what it stated was, anyone caught passing stool or urine anywhere but the proper places will immediately be asked to leave the community. So these were the two bulletin board announcements. Devotees shot by bikers, and do not pass stool and urine anybody's. So this was, you know, the announcements in the community at the time. I'll finish this up just on the building. So my wife and I then lived on the floor of the incense warehouse for the next 2 weeks, and no apartment came vacant. And
there were no apartments.
Because as Radhakanta had aptly stated, there were no apartments. That's correct. So Kirtananda had forgotten about that when he told me to move here in the middle of January. So I slept, my wife and I slept on the floor of that incense warehouse for 2 weeks until it was actually getting to be quite comfortable because I ran the woodshed. And I would make sure I had the warmest wood for the incense warehouse. So at the end of the day, at 6 o'clock, I'd run up there, I'd start a fire in the little burner, and my wife and I would then go to the bathhouses, bathe, come to the temple, and after nightly arti, we'd go back to the incense warehouse, and it would be nice and warm because I had lit a fire. And this particular night, 2 weeks after I moved here, I went into the bathhouse to bathe, and I was met as I walked in by the sight on... Well, first of all, to understand the bathhouses, when you walked in to the bathhouse, there were just pallets on the floor with a big pickle barrel full of water, and you would scoop a scoop in and pour it over your head. When I walked in on this night, there was a devotee standing on the pallets that I had never seen. For those of you who know Uttamoja, he was from Boston, and he weighed at the time about 450 pounds. So I walked into the bathhouse, and there was a 450-pound man standing naked, except for his Brahmin underwear, on the pallets. And I walked in, and I was... So I wanted to kind of show off for this devotee. So I thought, oh, here's a new devotee, and he had a Brahmin thread, and I wanted to show him how austere the new Vrindavan devotees were. So I could see him peering into the barrel of ice-cold water. So I thought, I'm going to show off here. So I jumped up on, got undressed, jumped up on the pallets, kind of scooted past him, and just threw my scoop into the water, and ice-cold water, pulled it out and threw it over me, and pouring scoops over me, and I'm suffering like mad, but I'm thinking, I'm here. This guy's going to think how advanced I am. He's a Brahmin, and he's scared, and I'm a new Vrindavan devotee. And so after I hit myself with about the fifth bucket of water, and the hairs were standing about that far off my body, goosebumps the size of fists are all over my body, the door of the bathhouse flies open, and Ambarish, I'm standing there naked, and Ambarish, in my, of course my Brahmin underwear, Ambarish looks in the bathhouse and he says, "Fire!" And I say, "Where?" And he says, "I already knew where." He says, "Incense warehouse!" So I jump off the pallets and I grab my pants and I throw them on. I go running out the door with no shoes on, a pair of pants wrapped around me. And as I'm running across the patio with the other devotees who are carrying buckets of water, I realize that I don't have my pants on, I have Uttamoja's. I'm holding them around my chest. And the incense warehouse is burning. And it's the only business that New Vrindavan has, the only means of support. And I'm standing there, and Kirtananda Maharaj is yelling, "Stay back, stay back!" I'm holding on my pants. And I'm feeling too embarrassed to let stand back, so I grab a bucket of water, and I run over and I throw it at the fire. But because the fire is, there's all oils in there, when the water hits the oils, the flames go back, and I go, "Oh, good," but then they shoot back out. And they burn off my eyebrows, burn off my eyelashes, and make my ears bubble. And I have Uttamoja's pants on. I'm standing there mid-January crying as the incense warehouse burns. That was another building in New Vrindavan.
the reason that these signs were around, because of, you know, the sign I mentioned about passing. Yes, Tara. Was because the outhouses were so horrendous that devotees would rather just hide somewhere in a corner and pass than go into the outhouses. We hadn't figured out how to clean out the outhouses. There was only one outhouse and, you know, 50, 60 people using it every day and sloshing a lot of water in it. And in the ice cold, the outhouses were so bad that as you stood in there, you could just peer out the cracks as you were passing and watch the birds and the trees and the freezing cold. But unfortunately, we couldn't get them clean, so sometimes the piles would come up over the top. So you had to kind of stand on your toes and make sure you were okay. I'll tell you some more stories about that later on if you'd like to know.
But
not in the temple room. But I have been asked to tell this one story, so I will. And I had to give the prelude of why people would pass in other places. And it became so bad that they had nicknames for people who would pass outside of the outhouse. And the most infamous one was the Mad Stooler. So the burning question in New Vrindavan was, who is passing? Who is the Mad Stooler? And the board meetings would go on for about 3 hours. A half hour was prasadam, and 2 hours and 15 minutes was, what are we going to do about the stool? Because it is mounting, and it's getting higher and higher. I can remember clearly one devotee saying, I went in there this morning, there was one as big as a baby seal. You have to do something. You have to. So this was going on around the community, and it was becoming critical. We had to build outhouses, but one day I was lying in my room, and I was, either I was sick or I was in Maya. More than likely, I was in Maya, and so, of course, we had no beds, or we just lied, the room was about 10 feet square, and I had our sleeping bag rolled in the corner. So this day, I was lying in my room, and I was sleeping lying with my head against the wall mid-afternoon. I was just kind of mental and out. And I'm lying there, it's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I lived right next door to Sudhanu and Lajavati. So I'm lying there and I hear someone come down the corridor and come into Sudhanu's room. So I'm thinking, huh, it must be Lajavati because it didn't sound like Sudhanu. It's only a thin wall between us. So I'm lying there with my head against the wall. And all of a sudden, I hear. What the heck is Lajavati doing over there? And it sounds like it's right in the corner where my head is. It doesn't sound like it's landing in a bucket or anything. I don't hear any echo, just a straight tickle, 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 tickle. And I'm lying there completely stunned, but I don't know what to say to Mother Lajavati. And then I hear the noise stops, and I hear the door to their room open, and I jump up and I open my door and I see a devotee, a woman scooting down the hallway. So I open Sudhanu's room and I look in, and sure enough, the Mad Stooler had visited. She did not stool, I will say that here. But she did wash Sudhanu's floor. And one of the stories of New Vrindavan. I'll pass the mic on.
I don't know how to follow that.
I would say I did get a note asking me to tell that story. I don't want to take all the weight here. I think it came from him, I'm pretty sure. Sitting over there humbly. I'm taking all the weight here. I did see him pick up a pen.
One of the episodes that I remember from Bahulavan
was the, we can talk about the hepatitis episode. Sudhanu Prabhu was in India after we got the first string of songs for Radha Vrindavan Chandra carved in Bombay in Bhuleshwar Market. Kirtananda said, why should we have so many plans, let our people learn how to do these things, because that's the way we did things at New Vrindavan. We learned to do them ourselves. We built a palace ourselves, we built the building. We would just go to craftsmen and learn the art and then do it ourselves. So he sent Somadas and Sudhanu to Bombay to learn the carving art so that we could carve all of our future temples. Well, Sudhanu came back from that and he had gotten really sick, and he had, unbeknownst to us at the time, he had contracted hepatitis. From time to time, we would have college classes come and visit the community. We were obviously unusual, extraordinary. Sociology classes would come, sometimes philosophy, religion classes. So, West Virginia University, a professor, was it West Virginia? Yeah. West Virginia, I think. Might have been Ohio.
Ohio Wesleyan.
A professor brought a group of students here and they spent the day and had a very nice time. Unfortunately, prasadam was cooked by Sudhanu, who had just returned from India and was in the contagious stage of hepatitis. So, not only was Sudhanu cooking for the guests, but he was cooking for the whole community. So, shortly after that, a number of devotees became very sick. And when taken to the local hospital, found out that we had a rash of hepatitis. So, immediately, the community was quarantined off. No one was allowed in or out, unless it was okayed by the police. They blockaded both sides of the community. And there was a Ayurvedic doctor here at the time, Dr. Trivedi. And he had explained to us that the only way we could get through the hepatitis was if we would, the only thing we could eat was mung water and rice. Or was it just mung water? A little bit of rice. Rice and mung. Yeah, no spices, no salt, just mung water and rice. Well, the first dilemma for the devotees was not really how to cure the hepatitis, but what was going to happen to the Mahaprasada. So Kirtananda went out and bought a freezer because they told us we would be quarantined for about a month. So his plan was to take the Mahaprasadam, all the offerings for a month, and freeze them in the freezer. And when the devotees, then, after their fasting and eating only mung water and rice, then we would have a major distribution of the Mahaprasadam. Well, I think the first freezer was blown up. Is that what you told me?
There was these locks, the type of locks they put on bank vaults, that was locking the door of the freezer so that no devotees could break in. It was a huge, heavy freezer. That's where the Mahaprasad was kept. So one day the freezer was gone. After taking the Mangalarti offer, we went to the freezer, and the freezer was gone. So we were looking all over for the freezer, and finally, days later, out in the forest, this huge freezer was open with dynamite. And there was nothing left.